Hello, this is Ben Burrell here, and welcome back to Bob Dylan Album by Album. This is not really a normal episode of the podcast. The podcast is still very much on hiatus. However, I wanted to bring you a little chat I had recently with Jake Brennan, who you will know as host of the Disgraceland podcast, the wildly popular music podcast. This is basically where Jake kind of tells you the stories of disgraced musicians getting away with murder and generally sort of behaving badly. It's a brilliant, brilliant listen. For my money, it's one of the best music podcasts out there. He also has a company called Double Elvis. They produce loads of great music podcasts. And like Disgraceland, what I particularly like is that they don't go down the normal route of kind of just having, you know, two blokes sat in a room talking endlessly. Which, you know, when it's done well, is great. But when it's not done well, not so good. Double Elvis kind of shy away from that, and they put on proper productions, rather. And I think Disgraceland is a shining example of that. Jake and Double Elvis also made Blood on the Tracks, which I've mentioned on this podcast a few times. I was lead writer on the latest season of that podcast, and we of course concentrated on Bob Dylan. It was essentially, you know, like a first person narrated sort of podcast, all about Bob's life from 1966, from the motorcycle crash right through to now. And there's so many highs and lows in there, so many fascinating stories to tell as well. You know, like Bob going through his Christian period, his born again period. We also heavily featured his sort of private life in a hopefully responsible way, and we had a look at just some real lows of his career and how he got out of that and how he had this big comeback. It was so much fun to write. I really enjoyed being involved with it, and judging by your reaction as well, you really enjoyed it too. So thank you if you have listened. If you haven't heard the latest season of Blood on the Tracks, I urge you to go and seek it out. It sounds so, so good. That is a big credit to the Double Elvis team, particularly the score of the podcast sounds so, so great. So I urge you to go and seek it out if you haven't done so already. I talked to Jake all about that. I talked to him all about Double Elvis and all about the Disgraceland podcast as well. Of course, we get into Bobby D too. So I hope you enjoy this chat with Jake Brennan. I shall return at the end of the episode, and I'll let you know a little bit more about what else is happening with the podcast. I'll see you then. Well, first things first, Jake, thank you so thank you so much for letting us do this season on Bob Dylan. What a treat it's been. What a strange, wild treat it's been to do this season. Before we get into that, though, I noticed that Disgraceland passed 100 episodes recently. So congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. And congratulations to you, too. I can't talk to you without just completely expressing my utter shock and gratitude at how incredible you managed to write this series that we did. We can talk about Disgrace in a minute, but man, you just knocked Blood out of the tracks, out of the park. It is amazing. And this is the first time we've actually really talked. So I just got to get that out of the way. Incredible job, for real.
Thank you.
Yeah. Graceland, 100 episodes. And we've never covered Bob Dylan until now, really, at Double Elvis with Blood on the Tracks. But 100 episodes for Disgraceland was completely surreal. Never thought we'd get this far. It's a testament to all the amazing people we have working here at Double Elvis and the great partners like yourself who help us out as well. So thank you.
Well, how come no Bob Dylan on Disgraceland? Is he? Because he's a bit of an outlier, I guess. But does he? He doesn't really. I guess he's a bit disgraceful, but not too much. Is that why?
Well, for those who don't know, Disgraceland is a podcast about musicians and true crime, either the true crimes that happen to them or that they commit. And when I dive into a subject, I'm essentially telling that subject's story through their criminal transgressions. And, you know, there has to be an actual crime. And with Dylan, I wasn't really sure there was one until listening to the Last Waltz depiction that you wrote in Blood on the Tracks, where spoiler alert, where Dylan steals the film canisters from Martin Scorsese. And I was literally, as I was thinking about it, Ben, I was like, oh man, this is my in. It's that Dylan episode. But Yeah, I mean that's why there's no real hardcore crime there that I know of with Dylan, despite that stuff that's bubbled up in the news lately that I'm not so sure is actually true.
I thought that particular bit in the Blood on the Tracks season was interesting because there's sort of this rumor that did happen, that he did steal the film, the tapes, the reels from The Last Waltz. But because everyone was so off their face, because everyone was so coked up on that night, no one can quite remember what actually happened. So there's so much hearsay around it. So we had a real good time with that episode, I think, because it was fun to kind of explore that kind of myth, I guess. And that I guess that's what the whole season was about, really, because, you know, Dylan's just one big myth and we just kind of tried to explore it as much as possible.
I was thinking about this and, you know, Dylan, you mentioned that he's an outlier before. He is for many reasons, but he's always struck me as this type of artist who has complete control over his celebrity and his stature in music history. And I feel like he's always playing us in the best way possible. Like he's in on a joke that only very few people are. And that's sort of how I've always kind of viewed him, you know, like he doesn't take it all that seriously. But on the other hand, he knows that there's a showman aspect to sort of writing your own myth. And he's done that better than anyone in music history, in my opinion.
Yeah, totally. I think the kind of, I guess people don't know, but the genesis of the Blood on the Tracks season was this weird Rolling Stone article. I don't know if you've read it, but it is basically him doing that in real time, him kind of just basically presenting a joke that no one understands apart from him and maybe like one other person in the entire world. And he's talking about all sorts in there, like transfiguration, and that obviously becomes a big theme for the season. I was going to ask actually, because when you approached me to do this, that was the kind of starting point, that article. Obviously that's very different from true crime, which is something that Blood on the Tracks has dealt with before. Why did you decide to make that switch between kind of like the Phil Spector season and the John Lennon season, where there's very, very deliberate kind of crimes that have happened, to this slightly weird Bob, like freeform Bob Dylan season?
Yeah, well, this show has evolved into something not totally different from what it originated as. But when we started, I was looking for a way to tell long form stories about musicians and crimes that were serialized rather than anthologized like I do with Disgraceland. So we started with Phil Spector because I knew I could get 10 episodes out of the Phil Spector story and the crime at, you know, at the end of his career, the murder, et cetera. And then, you know, we sort of from there, we're like, okay, well, let's go to John Lennon. We did a season on John Lennon, and that was about the crime that happened to the artist. And we had called the series Blood on the Tracks, no relation to Bob Dylan, knowing full well that, you know, it was a Dylan album. But it just seemed like a perfect title for the Phil Spector story as well, and a nod to Bob Dylan, nod to music history. But by the time we came across that Dylan article, we had an established format and we felt like we could veer away from the true crime element a little bit and kind of like lean into the myth of it all, the insanity, or I should say calculated insanity that Bob Dylan seems to possess at some times.
Yeah, I think calculated insanity is the kind of perfect phrase for it, because he seems to invent this insanity out of nowhere. But yeah, no, I was really pleased that you said that, because originally when you talked about doing this season, I was worried, like you say, there's not really a lot of true crime when it comes to Bob Dylan. He's one of the few big artists that hasn't been involved in something like that. So I think it was fun to kind of explore his myth, if you like. Although at the end, we do get to kind of the lonesome death of Hattie Carroll and stuff like that at the end of the season, which is interesting. He always seems kind of like adjacent to crime almost, like he's just sort of watching it and documenting it, if you like.
Well, I mean, that's music. That's the history of music. It's all adjacent. And of course, there's a great tradition of folk music and sort of the bad man and this old weird Americana and all the stuff that Dylan messed with the band. I mean, that rubs up all those themes and characters, those outlaws. They're all part of Dylan's sort of musical DNA. And of course, he plays an outlaw in one of my favorite movies ever, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. and he's a phenomenal actor in that film. So I think he's steeped in it, you know, in one way or another, in the best possible way, because he's not in jail, which is great.
Is Hearts of Fire also one of your favorite films of all time?
No.
What a surprise. What a surprise. It's funny you should mention that, actually, though, about the old weird Americana. I did try to do a whole episode of Bob retelling like those weird folk tales, those kind of like murder ballads. But I think it was just a little bit too weird. So I sort of gave up halfway through. But we do try and weave them in.
Yeah, you should pitch him on that podcast idea. I feel like I'd listen to that. Like, he can do it. He can tell those tales himself.
Maybe that's the next one to come. As far as you, what's your kind of personal story with Dylan? I mean, I'm assuming you're a fan, but are you kind of a mega fan, or are you just a pleasant observer?
Not a mega fan, but a huge fan, I should say. I mean, I just feel like the Dylan mega fan is such a thing, and I am definitely not that. I've read... you know, I read his book, which I thought was great. And I saw the Scorsese thing on him, which was incredible. And I grew up listening to him. One of the most interesting books I read on him is a book that I believe he hates. It was written by his body man, his security guard. I can't think of his name at this point. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, you're nodding. Yeah.
But he's always appealed to me because, you know, he's in the beginning, I didn't realize as a kid why he appealed to me. You know, when I was a kid and I put that first record on, I must have been 16, 17 years old, and it's just him and an acoustic guitar, and it's so filled with energy, anger, and poetry, and this just stream of consciousness that just, it's arresting, and it really grabbed me in the way the punk rock had previously grabbed me, and the way the hip hop grabbed me as well. And it was, and I got, you know, I understood why he was so celebrated. And now I understand why people were at the time sort of writing his own myth for him, and why he bucked so hard against that, famously at Newport Folk, and then on tour in Europe with the band, and really for the rest of his career. Like, he's constantly trying to claim himself back from the world. And there's something like, that's hard to do, man. It would have been so easy for him to just play nice and do the things that they want you to do, and he could have just rode off into the sunset. And you know, I could name five other musicians from his generation who have done the same thing and have had probably had an easier life. So I think that tension that he's created has always made him super compelling and interesting for me, but never to the point of an obsessive. You know, I tend to, like most people, I'm sure, I tend to dive into different eras of Dylan at different times. Most recently, the Infidels record is amazing. Street Legal, those are sort of the things I'm listening to these days. And there's even records I've yet to really delve into, like Self-Portrait, and you know, there's he's still making great music as well. I mean, some of the stuff he does, you talk about it in the last episode, I think, of Blood on the Tracks. Like, he sort of reinvents himself by the end of the 90s, and some of those early 2000s albums are they're so good. They're incredible. What's the one after Love and Theft? The one after he won the Grammy.
So there's a Time Out of Mind in 97 and Love and Theft's in 2001. And then it's Modern Times after that.
Yeah, it's actually Love and Theft. That's the one I'm thinking about, because Time Out of Mind is what he won the Grammy for. Love and Theft, I think that's with Charlie Sexton on guitar. It's just, my God, it's so good. It's as good as anything from the 60s. It's incredible. So I don't know. I'm meandering here with just gushing over Bob Dylan, but yeah, my relationship was to him. That's sort of.
You've come to the right person to gush over Bob Dylan, so it's fine. Yeah, I think it's interesting you say there about he's kind of spent his whole life trying to claim himself back, which I think was a lot of the stuff that kept coming up again when I was researching the season. He basically has become this big icon, and he's lived that since he was a teenager, and it's kind of hard to escape that. And there's some really like sad stories from him, especially in the 80s when, you know, his career's kind of going through a bit of a change. Some sad stories about him kind of feeling like just incredibly lonely. It's the classic kind of like Elvis thing, I guess, of just being surrounded by people, but kind of feeling so, so insular. I think that was interesting. And I think, again, like you said, he had to kind of go through that phase to get to where he is now. And that's this really celebrated artist, like legacy artist, who's still producing really good records. And I think, it, you know, it's it's kind of great, really, because otherwise he might have been one of those artists that just didn't recover in the 90s and just became like a proper heritage act now and didn't release any new material and just became one of those real former stars. But he seems to have had this great third act to his career, and I kind of hope we got that across in the final couple of episodes.
Yeah, you do, 100%. And I think if he didn't sort of rebound musically there at the end like he did, I think he would have just walked away and had done something else creative. I mean, the guy's not lacking for interests and things to do. I mean, he's clearly interested in a lot of things. Baseball. I mean, he's got a bourbon distillery, I think, that he's opening. Yeah. Or a whiskey distillery. He has there's some NFT thing that he's doing. There's a museum this red is opening as well. I mean, he's firmly of the zeitgeist as he's always been. And I feel like he would have been no matter what, just maybe in a different medium if it weren't for music at the end there.
Yeah, I think he's into sculpting gates as well, which, you know, who would have seen that coming back in the 60s? He's going to be a gate sculptor. I think he's one of those people that's annoyingly good at everything. He's just like super talented at everything, which is quite irritating. We tried to kind of get that over in the final couple of episodes of Blood on the Tracks, that he has had this great career resurgence, because not everyone knows that. I think if you are a big music fan, you sort of do know it, and you probably know Time Out of Mind, as you say, it won a Grammy. But I think some people are kind of not too aware of that. So I think we really tried to put that across. We also tried to put the man across in Blood on the Tracks as well, in that he's, you know, sometimes he's just not a nice person.
Despite all of our best efforts, we're all kind of a dick at some point. I mean, we really are. I mean, I try really hard not to be a dick. Sometimes I'm just a dick, and I don't even, that's usually when you don't even realize. And, you know, who's got a bigger spotlight on them than Bob Dylan? So I think, you know, and plus it's like the things that Bob Dylan's dealing with are just, I mean, meeting the Pope. You know what I mean? Or performing 3 feet from the Pope. Like, these are not normal things. They tend to raise your anxiety in ways that our anxiety is not pitched. So I give the guy a bit of a pass. But you also get to, there's a sweetness to him and an innocence as well that in our podcast, I think, comes out most noticeably in his affection towards George Harrison, which you beautifully write about. And that really made me happy to hear, because we most often hear about, you know, in relation to the Beatles, we hear about getting them high, and you cover that to great effect as well. But really, I think the way you word it is, you know, Dylan likes to think of him as a Wilbury and not a Beatle. And I thought that was really, really special. And I also, just side note, I loved the whole like historical Wilbury sort of social history that you weave in. It's just incredible. If anyone hasn't heard Blood on the Tracks, you gotta hear what Ben's done here. It's really great.
Yeah, that was fun. That I think that the idea for that came from the liner notes on the, I think it's on the first record, and they wrote kind of like a fictionalized history. So we just kind of ran with that. But yeah, that was fun. But yeah, it was nice writing the George Harrison like parts in particular, because I think he really. I think he had a strange relationship with the Beatles in a way. I think he wasn't friends with Paul McCartney for whatever reason. I don't think there was any malice there, but they weren't kind of best of friends. The John Lennon thing was really interesting, because it feels like they were fiercely competitive and were both similar people in similar situations, and therefore couldn't ever be like best of friends. But there's definitely a big mutual respect there. But with George Harrison, it felt like he was really good friends with him, and you know, obviously him not being around anymore, I think that was a big deal for Dylan, and I think that they shared a lot, and he felt like he had someone there he could speak to that had been through similar things to him but not quite in the same way, and we know that George Harrison was obsessed with Bob Dylan. I mean, if you watch Get Back, the Beatles documentary, he's constantly mentioning it. it's like a love affair almost.
Right. Yeah, George suffered from that little brother thing, I think, with Paul and John, but he had an openness to him that I think Paul and John probably didn't have, and John, I think, was highly competitive with Bob. It doesn't seem that George was, or if he was, it didn't play into the dynamic of the relationship that I know of. But yeah, it would have been fun to hear what else they could have done together besides Wilburys.
Was there anything in the season that you kind of raised an eyebrow about? Anything that you didn't know particularly before? Because that was another kind of challenge we had of dropping stuff in that people didn't maybe know. And like you say, everyone knows the Bob Dylan story about getting the Beatles high in that hotel room. But we desperately tried to put in like little bits that people had never heard before. So I was wondering if there's anything stuck out.
Yeah, I mean, it's endless. I mean, I mentioned one before, the sort of the scene where I didn't know he performed for the Pope. I just didn't know that. But he's not only performing for the Pope, he's performing. He's like 3 feet away from him in front of 300,000 people, which is just mind blowing. There's sort of this like goofy side of this like absent-minded side of Bob Dylan that is represented, that I think is very much part of his character, sort of the aloof artist. And I mean that in a positive way. I don't mean it in a pretentious way. But he's sort of like, not to give too much away, I could go through about five of these, but there's one in particular where he shows up to see Dave Edmonds at his house in London. And he asks for Dave, and Dave lives at the actual house, but he's at the wrong house. So he's let in by this woman who's like the wife of a plumber or something. And Dylan's just like chilling, thinking he's going to see Dave in the Eurythmics, who never shows up. Little things like that really humanize the man, you know, that has this massive myth that we've been talking about. And I think it makes the show really, really relatable. You know, the stuff, his relationship with Christianity, I found to be really interesting. I think when it's written about or mentioned, it's done so in a negative light. And it was great to kind of just hear it represented from what we think is his point of view on it. I actually listened to that episode with my 8-year-old son, and it was, because I knew it was going to be safe. We were on a ride. I was like, all right, well, how dark can this one get? You know what I mean? And it was really interesting to him, like for him to hear, like he didn't understand what the big deal was. You know what I mean? He's like, why would people care? And I'm trying to explain to him. But I think that's a chapter in Dylan's life that is the people kind of just kind of like breeze by, and we obviously lean into it. And I wanted to ask you, what's your opinion on where he's at now with Christianity? Because it's sort of the end of the series, he kind of makes reference to connecting with Jesus again in the end. And that's kind of where it ends. And I wonder if he's still there.
Yeah, it's a funny one. I think if you look at his career as a whole, every time he's made a big decision, he's sort of completely cut that thing out of his life. You know, like folk music, he kind of cut it out. And religion, when he stopped overtly singing about it, he almost cut it completely out from his art, certainly his public life anyway. And I think he does that to protect himself. Same with his private life and his marriages. I think he just completely cuts them out of public view because he feels like he's always going to be questioned on them, or they're going to be something that defines him. So I think that's quite an interesting reaction from him. And I think even though to us from the outside, it looks like he's turned his back on religion, if you look at his work from then on, right through to now, right through to the last album he released, Rough and Rowdy Ways in 2020, there's still so much religion in there. There's so much spirituality in there that I think personally he's still closely following something. And I don't know if it's particularly just Christianity or he's I don't know what, it's a hybrid maybe, but I feel like he very much is engaged still in religion and that area of things. But I don't think at this point we'll ever really know the specifics of that because he's sick and tired of talking about it, which is a shame, I guess. But and it's kind of our fault because, you know, he started singing about Jesus on one record that grew to three records and then everyone went crazy. As you say, like looking back now, it kind of seems strange to see that reaction to it. And actually, while I was researching the episode, I found an amazing, there was a radio spot, like a radio advert or commercial, if you're American. And it was like they'd obviously sent someone from the radio station out to record the audience that had just finished watching a Bob Dylan show, and it was on one of the religious tours. So he was singing exclusively religious songs at this time, and they were speaking to the audience as they left the venue. And some people were saying it's amazing, but the majority of people were saying, like, I can't believe he's doing this. Like, this is awful. Like, how dare he come here and sing these songs? How dare he preach to us? And it was so strange to hear, like, that reaction in our world now, because I think if an artist did that now, there'd be some pushback against it. But I think people would be like, wow, they're embracing this new direction. This is really exciting. But it was so anti-religion, and it was kind of quite vicious from the fan base. So I found that really interesting. And that was really good to hear for the episode, because it gave me a good perspective on just how big a change it was. Because, you know, I wasn't around when he went to Christianity.
I think of all the artists of the 60s, save for maybe the Beatles, you know, it's hard to think of another that where the fans felt more possessive of them than Bob. Like this sort of like, he's constantly like running into this sort of like this concept of betraying the fans, which is like, come on, give me a fucking break. He's an artist. You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't owe you shit. He owes you the opportunity to listen to his records, whatever he decides they may be, or to come see him in concert. And it's really interesting now to think, yeah, what would it be like now if an artist of similar caliber did that? Can you imagine if Jay-Z did that? Like, people be like, oh, this is great. You know what I mean? Or Drake, you know, they'd be, you know, I mean, it depends on the art. If Miley Cyrus did it, people would raise eyebrows, but I don't think they'd be shocked, you know?
Can you imagine Miley Cyrus's Christian album? I'm not sure. I don't know how that would turn out.
yeah, I don't either. But I mean, I'm kind of half expecting Jack White to do it at some point. It just makes perfect sense. But it just says something about the times and the man and sort of the idea, the sort of mythology. But all that criticism, you know, even as a young person, when I first encountered it, it seemed selfish and silly to me, and still does.
Yeah, it's funny. I think, again, this goes back to the whole season, and the main themes of the season were kind of transfiguration and also his life journey from the motorcycle crash right through to now. And the transfiguration thing, I think, maybe is an explanation as to why the fans do feel so possessive over him, because he has this tendency to do something that is really great for a couple of years and then just move on. And like I was saying, just like completely cut it out almost. So we go from him being a folk star to a rock star. And then, of course, post motorcycle crash, he's this kind of stay at home dad that's making these country records. And I think people got comfortable with him doing one particular thing and really enjoyed it. And then all of a sudden he's off. So all of a sudden you've lost that one thing that you loved, that part of him that you loved, and he's gone on to something else. And of course that's going to breed criticism, because, you know, he's taking away something you're really enjoying. But I think in the long run, without that, he's just nowhere near the same artist. He's just your kind of regular folk singer, I think.
Yeah, I really don't understand that reaction. Maybe it's because I've grown up, you know, making things. But, you know, as you go through life, you just get interested in different things. You can't help it. And, you know, you weren't making podcasts 5 years ago. You know what I mean? Like, now you are, and you'll be doing something else in 5 years. It's a natural progression, but you're still you. Your fans, your audience, your people, they should still want to be interested in you. I think there's this unrealistic, maybe it was this unrealistic expectation of the audience of Bob Dylan, which, you know, we've mentioned now a couple of times, but maybe it was also something to do with the era, because it was so rock, the concept of a rock artist or musical artist, that I don't think they were supposed to go on for more than 10 years. You know what I mean? But so I guess there is this expectation that you're just going to be Frankie Valli and do the same thing over and over and over again or something. It just seems silly in the rear view now. You know what I mean? It seems even more silly.
Yeah, but I think, yeah, you're right. I think at the time it was so different. But I guess that's why he's kind of a pioneer in a way. And that's why I always feel like he is kind of at his heart he's a real punk at his heart, because he kind of, yes, he just does, you know, whatever the hell he wants to, and quickly as well, and goes all in on it. And I kind of feel like he's almost as punk as someone like, you know, Sid Vicious or you know, Mick Jones, because he does have that same attitude of like, if you think that's wrong, or if you think that I shouldn't do that, then I feel I do, then like, fuck you, I'll do whatever the hell I want to, and if I think it's right. And you know, you see that overtly with stuff like obviously Going Electric and going religious and then doing whatever the hell he wants to, but also little moments. And there's one actually in Blood on the Tracks that we cover where he plays the Letterman show. And he's just released Infidels. And funny you should mention that earlier. And bearing in mind, Infidels is like this big comeback album, and it's quite a contemporary sounding album. And he's just basically come back to pop music after that religious period. He goes onto this really exciting new late night show and performs these songs in a way they've never been heard before. They never heard this way since. It's like kind of like a new wave, like punk again, sort of sounds. And he's just picked these guys up off the street. Like they just met them like a couple of weeks beforehand. And he brings on this late night show and plays these like reggae sounding tunes as like new wave songs. If you're in his record company, you must be like, what the hell are you doing? Like, we're trying to market this album. Please give us a break.
You're absolutely right. I got to say that's one aspect of Bob Dylan. I don't think I fully understand the subverting the performance of his own material live. You know, as I've sort of come to understand it, it's he's trying to keep himself interested, and that I fully get. And I also believe a song can be interpreted in a gazillion different ways, but I don't think the results for Bob Dylan are there. Like I've seen him three times, and it's been wildly high and wildly low.
Oh, really?
No but always interesting, you know, which I guess is saying something. It really is, actually.
What were kind of the lows? Was it just hearing songs that you didn't feel like you knew?
I could not even understand what the hell they were. You know what I mean? Like unrecognizable. But then again, it's like, if I'm being honest with myself, if I hear Bob Dylan play Knocking on Heaven's Door live once, I might get one moment where it's transcendent. You know what I mean? Where it equals the beauty of how that song is represented in Sam Peckinpah's Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, which will gut me and bring me to tears on almost every single time I watch that scene. I don't know that Dylan's capable. I don't know that any pop star is capable of doing that repeatedly night after night live. So in the absence of actually having any sort of emotional objective feeling, why not just fucking freak out and be weird? You know what I mean? It's just, we just have these expectations of how the rock concert's supposed to be. You know what I mean? And I think he's, again, to your point, he's like, fuck that. I'm doing this the way I want to do it. And it may include a wig and a weird mustache, and I don't care what you think.
I love that wig. That wig phase was a strange phase for us all. There's lots of big Dylan fans that no matter what he does, they will praise. I do remember I saw him at Hyde Park, just down the road from where I'm sat now, back in 2019. God, I can't remember. Yeah, it was 2019, something like that. And he lost the audience two songs in. And it was a big, big audience because they'd just seen Neil Young, and Neil Young had played, you know, a greatest hit set pretty much.
Wait, was it the same bill? Was
yeah.
it Bob after Neil?
No, Neil before Bob. They do like the big, they're called like British summertime shows. They do like big kind of headline artists together. And it was, you know, it was a rough ride. But the one thing that I took away from it was people around me were moaning, but when it got to Like a Rolling Stone, he did a piano version, and it's one of my favorite versions of the song. He slowed it right down, but the chorus still sounded like huge. It was still a massive, massive chorus. And, you know, 100,000 people sang along to it. And it was like, well, that's the moment we got in that concert. And it was worth waiting for, and it was worth going for. You know, if you have to sit through some other stuff that you're not enjoying as much, then fine. Not everyone wants to do that, but I was happy to do that day.
Yeah. I wish he would talk straight on what is actual. Maybe he is. Maybe he has, and we're just not accepting the answers on why he does what he does live. But, you know, I think he's what, 80 years old now, mm-hmm. and he's still on the never ending tour, and I'm happy to see that. I think I think I have a theory that these old guys, you kind of allude to it. You mentioned it straight up. Like in one of the episodes, you talk about how he says, You either get addicted to the road or the road eats you up or something like that. And I know that's true. I know old guys who are on the road, and I know that's their point of view. And I think part of them thinks they retire, they're just gonna be in the grave in a week. You know what I mean? And the act of playing live and continuing to use those muscles is what keeps the vitality going, keeps them alive. I think that's why he's doing it, because God knows he's got enough other interests to occupy his time, for sure.
Yeah, he doesn't need to tour, so there must be, like you say, there must be something that he finds compelling about it. And it's interesting, post-lockdown, he's spoken to the audience a lot more, and he's like kind of trotted out, you know, the classic Bob Dylan jokes. Like his stage banter, I think, is quite interesting. And we haven't heard it for quite a few years, but post-lockdown, he's kind of come back to it. He often sort of like lists off like history of the place he's playing, like the areas he's playing, and like sort of goofs on that, which is quite bizarre. But it's interesting that maybe kind of his time away from the road, he realized how much he does enjoy it and how much it is a part of him, because he seems to be enjoying it much, much more. But also I think for him, he changes the songs live so much because I think he feels that they are ongoing pieces of work, especially a song like Simple Twist of Fate, where the lyrics are kind of ever changing and he's always adding to them and taking bits away. And then every now and again, he'll drop like a bomb in them, and it will give you a better idea as to what the song is about. And, you know, once when he performed Simple Twist of Fate, he mentioned his 60s girlfriend, which I thought was quite interesting. He mentioned her by name. So I think he feels like they're never finished, the songs, even though they've been released on an album. For him, they're kind of always changing. So I guess there is that side to that. But, you know, it depends on if you're a concert goer, do you want to see that, or do you want to see a greatest hit set? I think probably most people would want to see a greatest hit set. But, you know, he's in charge. Dylan's in charge.
It's Bob Dylan. I think he's talking to people because, like the rest of us, he just misses being social.
Yes. Yeah. I'm desperate to know what he did during lockdown. Just sort of swaggered around Malibu, no doubt.
Well, I think he bourbon and NFTs. I think there's a museum.
Who'd have thought? What a way to spend your time. I'm conscious of your time, but just before we let you go, I'm just curious to kind of zoom out a little bit and talk about Double Elvis, because I think it's really exciting to hear music podcasts done really well and done in a compelling way. What's the kind of the idea going forward? We're obviously going to get a lot more stuff like this, but obviously Disgraceland's hit 100 episodes now. Is that going to continue? Is it going to get bigger?
Yeah, Disgraceland is definitely going to continue. Disgraceland has made possible the opportunity to create this company with Double Elvis and to create these other podcasts and these other series. And it's been amazing for me to be able to work with other creatives like yourself on some of these ideas that we have, ideas that you guys have, and really just find, you know, dude, like you, I'm sure we've seen every freaking music documentary there that's ever made, every biopic, every sort of tentpole book in the canon we've read. And we're still obsessed with music. And I love this medium because it gives us the opportunity to tell these stories in different ways that make it exciting for me. And obviously for listeners, given the response that we've seen. So we're going to keep at Double Elvis. We're going to keep, you know, in the spirit of our namesake, Andy Warhol, Declan Patrick, Aloysius McManus, aka Elvis Costello, Elvis Presley. We're going to keep leaning into making great music content. And yeah, I don't know what's in store except just more.
And is there anything you kind of that you're, I mean, you're super proud of it all, obviously, but is there anything you want people to be directed to outside of Blood on the Tracks? Is there kind of one Disgraceland episode that you think is kind of like the jewel in the crown or anything like that?
Honestly, I'm not just saying this, but the Miles Davis episode that is about to be released this coming Tuesday from when we're taping here, that'll be the beginning, the first week of May when that hits. It's a two-parter on Miles Davis. It's the best work I feel like we've done at Disgraceland. But if you're looking for an episode to start with, I'd perhaps start at the beginning, the first episode on Jerry Lee Lewis and the quote-unquote killer getting away with allegedly murdering one of his wives. And if you're looking for something more modern, maybe check out the Jay-Z episode or the Cardi B or Taylor Swift episodes. We've got artists from every era, every genre, and all kinds of transgressions and crimes.
That's the whole spectrum there. I love the way you stopped yourself and just said allegedly there. It's important to get that in. Jake, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you and to meet you as well. And thank you for letting us kind of run riot on this Blood on the Tracks season. It was so much fun. And I know that I've had so many messages from listeners who have really enjoyed it too. And believe me, it's hard to make Bob Dylan fans happy. So we must have done something right if they're pleased. So thank you once again.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you. You did an amazing job, as did everybody on the team that you worked with. I encourage everybody to check out Blood on the Tracks, the Bob Dylan story, hosted by Ben over here, Mr. Ben.
So thank you so much to Jake for chatting with me. And if you haven't checked out his podcast, Disgraceland, it is definitely, definitely worth a listen. Like I was saying earlier, one of my favourite music podcasts, I think. The Blood on the Tracks season is available in its entirety right now. You can binge listen to it if you want. Thank you so much to the Double Elvis team for allowing a Bob Dylan fan to truly go to town on his life story from 66 through to now. I'm particularly proud of the last episode as well. I think we try and deal with some themes that Bob has been dealing with in his career, and hopefully in some small way we contribute to that. So that was a lot of fun. So check out Blood on the Tracks season 3 if you haven't done so already. This podcast shall return later in the year. We're sort of running out of albums, like I mentioned on the last episode. So we'll probably get to our last run of albums in the next season of the podcast, which, as I say, will come out later in the year. In the meantime, I've got a couple of special episodes to drop for you. They'll be available throughout the summer. One, I think you'll particularly enjoy, all about Dylan's lyrics. We'll get to that over the summer. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you down the road.